We're discussing criminal justice and crime prevention on the campaign trail. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers last week directed another $50 million in federal funds to boost law enforcement and crime prevention programs. At a news conference in Milwaukee 1 week ago,
whether it's investing in mental health support and diversion, to getting folks fair and speedy trial, to bolstering reentry program, we're going to follow the science and use evidence-based, data-driven strategies to build a safer, fairer Wisconsin for everyone.
Courtesy of WITI-TV, what violence prevention strategies are most effective? Do you vote on a candidate's stance on police reform issues and criminal justice? 800-642-1234. John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at UW-Madison and an equity scholar at the Urban Institute, founder and director of the UW Justice Lab. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Kate, thank you for having me again.
So it's interesting, as gun violence has surged, so has this commentary about public safety reverting to a tough on crime approach. And as we explore ways to reduce harm and maintain public safety in our communities, how do you view this through a public health lens?
From a public health perspective, murder in particular, or gun violence more generally, is a major concern. But like other public health concerns, it is concentrated in certain communities. I do want to point towards the Marquette University Law School poll, which found that 69% of Wisconsinites believe that crime was increasing in the country as a whole, but only 21% believe crime is a problem in their community or in their day-to-day lives. So this speaks to how crime and gun violence more specifically is concentrated in certain communities.
How do you address the health of a person and lift up that public health approach to gun violence that cares for the well-being of individuals who are victims of deliberate systemic harm, who are victims of systemic racism?
Well, I think we often don't consider that a lot of people who are perpetrating gun violence have also been victimized by some form of crime. Mm-hmm. The way to address the root causes of a lot of gun violence is with wraparound services. So these aren't services that focus just on criminal legal system approaches, so like more cops on the street, but looking really at communities and specific people in communities and getting them targeted services.
Turning to the politicians, Governor Evers campaigned on a goal to cut Wisconsin's prison population in half. Where is that goal today?
So I actually just looked this up. We are trending down. We are in the lower end of not even the average, but we are moving down. The other part of his campaign promise was to really reduce racial disparities in who's going to prison and jails. And that's something I think that I'm glad he sort of shied away from. I want to bring that up because that's something that's very difficult to meet, right? I think the fact that he's turned towards focusing mainly on reducing the footprint of the size of the system is beneficial. He could have done better, especially through the Department of Corrections. While local jails have reduced their populations, the Department of Corrections has not done, I think, all that it could do, especially during COVID, when there could have been more innovative ways to reduce the number of people who are incarcerated, given the link between staff carrying or being the main vectors of COVID, right? So it wasn't just incarcerated people who had to worry about COVID. It's staff bringing COVID back into community. So I think if there was a more concerted effort, we could have even reduced more gotten more people out of prison.
I want to tease out a little bit more there. Governor Evers, who had expressed a desire to shrink disproportionate incarceration rates, and you feel like this is not the right approach. Can you talk a little bit more about what you see there?
So you mentioned systemic racism. What we see in the criminal legal system is an artifact of systemic racism. So not to say that there isn't systemic racism within the criminal legal system, and this is why there's a move to no longer call it the criminal justice system, right? Because there isn't much justice in it. But if we think about how racism works, it's not like a disease or within certain places. Systemic racism means just that. It's broad, it's far-reaching, and it's wide. There are other and better ways to address systemic racism, but the fundamental problem with our criminal legal system is it's just too big. Even in a state like Wisconsin, we've been trending down in certain parts of the state, our incarcerated population. But if you want to see racial justice, or racial equity, it would actually be better to just reduce the number of people in the system. You may actually see an increase in disproportionate rates by doing that, meaning that white people will be getting out at a higher rate than Black or Latinx folks. But the issue is, if you just reduce the number of people, you will have more Black, and the total number of Black and or Latinx people will be reduced, which I could say is a form of racial equity, right? It may not, this proportionality thing, I think we get too caught up into how numbers are calculated. And we need to focus on how people's lives really can be changed.
John Eason with us, UW Madison Associate Professor of Sociology, specializing in equity, in criminal justice reform. You can join in. What do you make of the way politicians talk about crime, how lawmakers push policy? Do you think elected officials can reduce crime, or is it beyond their control? 800-642-1234 to join in. Jen, you've done so much research, and we've talked about before that this idea of a school-to-prison pipeline, suggesting that some populations are born on their way to prison, so to speak, which is fundamentally racist. How does this mentality factor into our legal and societal framework, how politicians talk about crime?
So the so-called school-to-prison pipeline is really about the increased likelihood of Black and Latinx children. In Wisconsin, it's more specifically a type of anti-Black racism that's more pronounced. But that leads to children not only being denied opportunities in school, like being in advanced or gifted courses or AP courses, but also a high likelihood of them being labeled as bad or problem children and being pushed into detention and the like, which can lead to them being more involved with the criminal legal system. And this starts as early as pre-K, with more than half of all children in pre-K being Black boys that are expelled, right? So if you start really early, with the three and 4 year olds being labeled and deemed as really bad students or bad people, it makes it difficult for them to be tracked any other way. And it actually makes it easier for them to be pushed into the path of being involved with law enforcement. So if you look at the socioeconomic background along with race, I'm not saying one or the other, but many African Americans in Wisconsin have a lower socioeconomic status, so that makes them more susceptible to being caught up in the criminal legal system.
UW-Madison sociologist with us at the intersection of crime prevention, policing, and the tactics politicians employ for their policy agenda on criminal justice. John Eason stays with us. What sort of policing and criminal justice policies do you want state lawmakers to act on? If you see a candidate labeled quote-unquote soft on crime in campaign ads, how does that make you feel? How worried are you about crime activity in your own community? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with John Eason here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing a criminal justice campaign agenda, what it means for Wisconsin communities on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here is former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish on the campaign trail in February seeking the Republican nomination to challenge Democratic Governor Evers in November.
I will back the badge, and we need to end this nonstop cycle of violent criminals being let go on low bail so they can terrorize communities some more.
Courtesy of WTMJ-TV, do you think people in elected office follow through on policing and rhetoric, criminal justice rhetoric? What policies have a positive effect on crime prevention? 800-642-1234. UW-Madison sociologist John Eason, head of the UW Justice Lab, with us for about 9 more minutes. John, you hear Rebecca Clayfish there and looking more about putting police officers on the streets. She wants to put 1,000 more police officers on patrols. And this echoes a Republican package of bills in the legislature that would put state money toward police recruitment and retention. How would increasing the number of police officers change crime rates?
I don't know that there's good science that supports her claim. In fact, there are communities that are often over-policed and receive aggressive policing. I think that if we better funded municipalities, we could actually see municipalities hopefully make the right choices in terms of not just who they hire, but how they train. And just throwing money and cops at the problem is not going to address it. And 1,000 police across the state or in certain communities, and have these communities ask for police, or are they asking for resources that could accompany police? There's often mental health crises that people may be involved in that could better be suited if a response could better be suited to those specific characteristics of a call if municipalities had the funding to address that. And she was also part of the prior administration, which cut a lot of money to local municipalities, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a huge issue. But yeah, I don't see how just throwing police at this issue. Police aren't the only crime preventers. In fact, they show up when a crime has been committed. Strong communities actually do better with crime prevention. And if they have support of their government, if the government is supporting those communities, that's a better deterrent. The science behind this has been pretty well proven since the early 90s.
Let's bring on a caller now. John is with us from Eau Claire. Hi, John. What would you like to add?
Well, my comment is that this discussion, as so often is the case, ignores the elephant in the room. And we must start with recognizing the plain, utter statistic that the murder rate in Wisconsin, as in almost all states, is driven primarily by Black people. They are also the victims of this crime. But we can't ignore the elephant in the room. And we have to start preventative measures with asking, what is it in the Black community that causes them to vastly disproportionately resort to gun violence to solve basic problems in families and on our streets?
John Eason,
and until we recognize that.
And let's get John Eason in here to respond. Go ahead, John.
When I said that communities that suffer gun violence and also victimization, it is specific. It's not just place-based, it is racialized. But if you look at it, I'll take the caller's question on the nose. What is it that causes Black communities to have higher rates of gun violence? Well, this goes back to what I just was saying. If you have communities that have been underinvested or disinvested in for years, from schools to health facilities to the like, to a whole host of other public institutions that normally support pro-social behavior or what many Americans would consider normal behavior, if you will, quote unquote, normal behavior, you're asking a tall tale for folks that don't have a lot of resources. Also talked about the overlap, the lack of a Black middle class, if you will, the overlap of Black communities being disproportionately poor in Wisconsin. So when you have people that are concentrated into resource deprived neighborhoods, and you had the wide availability of guns like we do in America, it's not exactly surprising that we have the situation that we do. If you want to, the best way to address that situation is to provide resources and opportunities for people to improve their lives. If you continue to, and that's what's happened in this state, continue to cut resources into these neighborhoods, this is a product of systemic racism. The conditions, not the individual choices and actors. I think we want to make this about individual choices and actors, or somehow blame it on a culture of poverty or on Black culture, which is also a form of racism. But mm-hmm. if we just really look at what's happening here, right? Because white communities that are very impoverished, rural white communities that have high poverty rates actually have high gun violence and other types of violent outcomes in their communities, right? So this isn't a racial thing. It's not an individual thing. This is about us systematically disinvesting in communities. And these tend to be poor communities across the board, but poor communities of color suffered a dual stigma of disinvestment based on their socioeconomic status and their race.
John Eason with us, UW-Madison Associate Professor of Sociology, as we look at the criminal justice reform, the calls from politicians. John Eason, founder and director of the UW Justice Lab. Let's go to Jane now in Milwaukee. Jane, hi.
Oh, hi. I thank the speaker very much for all his hard work in this area. I have a question regarding when he brought up kindergartens, young kids. What is being done about the fact that in some cultures, physical discipline for children is accepted and actually saying, I was raised this way and it worked for me, and that it's a factor in this ongoing violence?
So violence at home and the repercussions there, John Eason?
So I've spent a lot of time in the American South. I've lived across the South. And it's interesting to think about how violence across racial categories perpetuates violence. So research shows that disciplining children has no real effect. Harsh discipline, not disciplining, but harsh discipline, physical violence against children has no effect on them being more compliant. I can't speak to the degree that children who are being abused at home are going out and being the major cause of gun violence or other types of violence. I actually think neglect, which also accompanies abuse. I think the neglect and lack of resources in these communities it's a much bigger problem for young children being involved with or being what was once called at risk, right? Mm-hmm. So those children being more involved in violence and being more involved in activities like drugs and the like, child abuse is tied to that, but I think neglect, which often accompanies abuse, is a bigger issue than the abuse itself. If we had more wraparound services, it would probably help those children.
There we hear about the wraparound again. John, thank you for joining us.
Kate, thank you so much for having me, and you guys have a great day.
You too. John Eason, Associate Professor of Sociology at UW-Madison and Equity Scholar at the Urban Institute, runs the UW Justice Lab. Stay with us as we take a look at criminal justice policy and reform at the national level with a reporter from the Marshall Project. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the political rhetoric around safer communities and funding and policies behind a public safety agenda. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Homicides, violent crime, reckless driving, they've all spiked in our state's largest city, Milwaukee. Wisconsin as a whole saw a 70% year-over-year increase in homicides last year. Governor Evers said a week ago, the violence is another public health crisis that deserves attention and action. What crime reduction steps have worked for your community? Has your city had extensive conversations about policing? What do you think of politicians taking a stance on issues like gun control or no-knock warrants? 800-642-1234 to join in. Jamiles Lardy is a staff writer for the Marshall Project. That's a nonprofit newsroom focusing on criminal justice. Jamiles, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, crime being such a common talking point from stump speeches from politicians on the campaign trail, how much stake should people put in a politician's claims that they can reduce crime and can increase public safety?
I guess I would say a medium amount. What's certainly true is that criminal legal policy and social policy more generally affects safety, affects crime, affects social outcomes. So it's not like the weather. It's not like, you know, crime is just a thing that happens and no policy that policymakers introduce or try to execute will never do anything. But as someone who covers criminal legal policy, I would say there's also a certain level of skepticism that one should bring to the sales pitch around any one given policy. Generally, you know, any given policy is less impactful or at least more complicated with more trade-offs than the pitch that politicians will give on it.
I feel like there are multiple tensions here. You know, our country's grappling with a murder rate that has reached its highest point in a quarter century. And then you hear these conversations about rethinking policing that is less confrontational and less aggressive. And, you know, the tactics that turn communities away from policing. So how do you reckon with those types of tensions that are, you know, that the movement away from policing and those extreme tactics versus a murder rate that keeps going up and up?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And I think that's going to be the question of our of this year, certainly, as we go into the midterms. It's very clear that that's going to be front and center on voters' minds. You know, even with inflation the way it is, even with the pandemic still not over, it's clearly captured a lot of voters' attentions. And my answer is, there's a few ways to look at it. I mean, I think one important way to look at it is we haven't actually changed policing very much in the United States over these past 2 years. Hmm. So if the argument is that, you know, that you'll hear the argument made that it's because of all of these reforms and all of these new ideas in policing that the murder rate is spiking, but we haven't really changed that much. So I think there's one way to look at it, and there's a few here, is that the way that we have policed historically and the way we were policing in the late 1980s and early 1990s, when our homicide rate was double what it is now, hasn't hasn't worked, right? I mean, it is, to whatever degree it has worked, it has brought with it a lot of baggage. And it's not obvious that this is, that is the one way to sort of solve this problem, is to police more harshly, to give out more punitive sentences, for police to be more and more militarized. Like, we've done a lot of that over 40 or 50 years, and we're still one of the most violent nations in the country, even before this current spike. One of the most violent nations in the world.
It's interesting, too, as you say, that the policing hasn't changed that much, because over the past couple of years, we have seen these high-profile police shootings, the tragedies in Minneapolis and Kenosha and Waukesha. They have inspired legislative action. They have inspired bills moving through legislatures. So how do higher-profile police shootings affect the policy changes, affect the system?
Yeah, I mean, those moments certainly influence the rhetoric a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Their policy impact is kind of a different matter. George Floyd, along with Breonna Taylor, you know, look, those cases inarguably led to, by volume, the biggest influx of policy reforms in policing ever.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Dozens of states passed bills on no-knock raids, on chokeholds, on peer intervention, on decertification for officers. Under certain circumstances, the question becomes generally, you know, whether those reforms are enough or are impactful. The neck restraint that Derek Chauvin used on George Floyd was against department policy when it happened, and yet it wasn't mentioned in the initial account of the incident. So without video, think about what is the likelihood that Chauvin would have faced any sanction within the department for it if all we'd had to go on was that original press release that came out after that happened. So I think my point is that there are law and policy changes, and the argument is not that they are meaningless. They're not, but we haven't seen sort of broad reimagining of policing in ways that are going to change crime and change society.
What might those more broad reimaginings be? I mean, is it, you know, what does that look like? And what have politicians at all hinted that we're moving in that direction?
No, I think we're not moving in that direction. And I think certainly the current discourse around crime, like, to whatever extent there was a possibility that that we'd be moving in that direction as a nation or as individual states, the air was kind of let out of that, out of that balloon with the increased homicide rate nationwide. Mm-hmm. And with the kind of changing tone and tenor around crime and very legitimate fears around crime. But some of those sort of more, well, and so this is, again, it's a matter of scale and a matter of degree, right? So there are some folks who are police abolitionists, or who see quote unquote defund the police as sort of an avenue to something approaching police abolition, right? Reducing the size and scale of policing by half to start, I think is where a lot of folks in the defund movement kind of stick their flag. So that's kind of one version of that. But I'm also talking about states that have gotten a little bit more, maybe aggressive is not the word, but, you know, we could take a state like Washington State, where they did all the same reforms that were passed and signed in Wisconsin. They also did a bunch of other stuff. They created a new state agency to investigate police use of deadly force. They made it easier to sue individual officers.
Hmm.
They raised the bar for forceful detention. Like, in other words, you know, grabbing and throwing down someone or chasing someone who doesn't want to be questioned by the police. Now officers need probable cause versus just reasonable suspicion to do that. And that sounds, you know, technical and like something out of Law and Order. But, you know, what legal scholars will tell you, those are actually very different standards. And if it's enforced, that could change police encounters a lot. Now, I will pause to say that I believe I saw a news article yesterday that Washington Governor Inslee is actually looking at potentially rolling some of that back. There's been a lot of confusion and frustration and pushback from law enforcement. So I'm not sure what the final outcome is going to be on that law. But, you know, Colorado is another state that has certainly gone further on accountability, reducing the barriers to file state civil suits against officers. Virginia is a state where now officers cannot pull people over on the highways, on the roads for a number of kind of minor technical violations, like driving with defective or unsafe equipment or
a headlight out or something, tail light. Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so I think those are examples of things that, you know, are doing more than just sort of making more bureaucratic rules.
Jamiles Lardy with us, staff writer for the Marshall Project, as we look at criminal justice and policing, what lawmakers and politicians say. You can join in. What crime reduction steps have worked for your community? Has your community had extensive conversations around crime prevention? What has that been like? 800-642-1234 to join in. Jean is with us from Ashland. Jean, hi. You're an educator.
Yes, and this is cause and effect, and prisons and jails are populated by fetal alcohol effect and syndrome prisoners due to the alcohol and or drugs used by the mother and the father during, prior to and during a pregnancy. So my point is, go way back to cause and effect, the elephant in the room, and policing people who do not have an understanding of why they're committing crimes. In other words, that type of syndrome, that type of effect does not understand consequence of behavior. So you have to go back and police them differently with an understanding that their educational abilities are less than the average person. So that's my statement.
Okay, Jean, thanks. And Jamiles, what do you make of that, tracing this back to, you know, essentially, Jean says, how the child starts from the beginning, perhaps in a family that has had drug abuse, alcohol abuse?
Yeah, so I wouldn't, without having kind of data or research in front of me, I wouldn't go and say that that is most of the problem or much of the problem. I just don't have the evidence for that in front of me. What I will say is, I certainly hear you on the, there is a determinism to everything. Maybe that's getting a little philosophical for morning radio, right? But nothing just happens. Like, things happen for reasons. There are causes, there are root causes that lead to almost everything in society, not almost everything in society. And that means people's behavior. That means the laws that we pass, who we enforce them on, how we enforce them, what enforcing them looks like. I mean, all of that kind of boils down to root causes, to things that precede the person, things that precede the law, things that precede the action. So that point is very well taken, right? There is a need to kind of go back and look at the root causes for things that are things in our society that aren't working and that are causing harm.
Talking with Jamiles Lardy, journalist with the Marshall Project, as we discuss criminal justice, race, policing as a political agenda. What does bipartisan criminal justice reform look like to you? How do you feel about how our state handles juvenile offenders? Do you think politicians and lawmakers are in touch with the crime you see in your neighborhood? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jamiles Lardy here on the Ideas Network. We're at the intersection of crime prevention and policy action on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. President Biden, in his State of the Union address this month, said he's worked on these issues for a long time and highlighted the $350 billion in the American Rescue Plan for community violence intervention.
I know it works. Investigating crime prevention and community policing, cops who walk the beat, who know the neighborhood, and who can restore trust and safety. Let's not abandon our streets. or choose between safety and equal justice.
Courtesy there, C-SPAN. What choices has your community made around policing and violence prevention? What are root causes? How do you solve them? Still time, 800-642-1234. The Marshall Project's Jamiles Lardy is with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Matt in Nisida. Matt, you want to bring up the media. Go ahead.
Yes, the media, and then I had another question as well. So I'm just really happy that the focus seems to be more on root causes and community policing and less on blaming the objects that these crimes are committed with. I feel like the media likes to focus on that and then try to enact change to that end. So I'm really glad that it's, you know, more root cause and community policing. I really think that's the way to go. But the guest mentioned that crime was twice as bad, as twice as high in the 80s as it is now. And I think that people don't really understand that. And I blame the media. You know, they want us to feel like things are as bad as they've ever been all the time. And it's just not the case, and context would make such a big difference. So I would like to ask the guest what he thinks the media's role in that is, if any, and then also what caused that drastic reduction in crime between the 80s and now, and is that something we could look into to try to do more of?
Interesting, Matt. Thank you. Jamiles.
Yeah, to take those questions in reverse order, what caused that dramatic increase? We have no idea. I think, you know, if you ask 10 different criminologists, you might get 10 different answers. And if they're decent criminologists, they would admit to you first and foremost that they're not really sure. And that they'll give you a hypothesis. And so, you know, those hypotheses range. Some folks say that it's, you know, it was because of policing. It was because community policing, we hired, you know, a bunch of officers in the 90s, after the 94 crime bill, and that, you know, those extra officers and all of that extra policy was, you know, what did that. I've heard the argument that you know, one of the reasons it fell was because of the rise of video games, and because young men between the ages of 16 and 35 who commit the majority of violent crimes in our society had something else to do, right? There are 100 other answers sort of along that spectrum from, you know, from direct kind of criminal justice and criminal legal policy concepts to, you know, pretty out there social root cause ideas. And the best answer is that we don't know.
Meanwhile, what is on the evening news, right? And how this is framed in the media? Can you speak to that, especially from the Marshall Project's perspective?
Yeah, sure. I think the media has done a lot of damage, if we're kind of speaking in the broad sense, by, you know, this old. Old cliched adage of, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, right? So sort of covering crime in this very breathless, frenetic way, in ways that often do not speak to, again, this notion of root causes, but even more to the point, just don't offer context about crime rates in the society at large, right? When a single crime is an emotional story, and that's understandable. It should be, right? When a terrible thing happens to a person, that's bad. And we're allowed to feel like that's bad and to hear their story, to empathize with them, to potentially grieve with them without sort of losing that context of what does this mean for the broader society, right? So the statistic doesn't matter for the individual, and you know, we can't lose that either, right? Like if something terrible happened to your family because of crime, you don't care that crime is down, you know, 50% from what it used to be. Like it's personal, right? Mm-hmm. And so I do believe that the media has a responsibility to do both, right? To tell people's stories, and to sort of introduce that humanity into what's going on. But, you know, another thing that we, and so the media has traditionally done that on crime stories, but has traditionally not done that about the harm that our criminal legal system, that policing, that prisons have on people's lives, which is, you know, another place where there are extremely miserable circumstances that individual people and their families get put through by the system we have. Now, again, I used this phrase earlier and I'll use it again. You know, there are trade-offs in anything. There are trade-offs in the laws we write. There are trade-offs in how we enforce them. It may get you some kind of result that you want, and it may leave a lot of collateral damage in the way. And I think our media has done a poor job of tracking the collateral damage that our criminal legal system has done historically with our punitive tough on crime approach to things.
Let's go to Heather in Madison. Heather, hi.
Hi. Hello.
Hi, we can hear you. Go ahead.
My comment is that research has shown that countries around the world that have the lowest crime rates have significantly more education than we do in this country. And what do you think that the impact of that is could be on our crime rates?
Can you make a connection there, Jamiles?
Sure. I think that's a great observation. And I've seen those studies too. And I think there's probably something to that, but I don't think you can, it's not just as simple as educating your way out of crime, right? Because it's also possible that the education, right? This is just kind of one of those, is it a correlation or a causation? It may be that there are things that, about those societies that make them, that make people get more education, that also make their crime lower. It's not necessarily that the education is leading to the lower crime rates, but I'm always, you know, happy to advocate on behalf of more education in any situation. So,
well, we're short on time, and I just want, because you listed off a bunch of different states putting policies together, what is one or two national criminal justice policy moves you're watching that you think will have a significant impact?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so as a reporter, I think my role is not to, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to advocate for any specific policies. But I am interested to see if we get more of those laws, like the ones I mentioned, about that narrow the realm of when police can detain and engage people. It catches my attention because, you know, we started this segment talking about the politics of it all. And I think it's something that can actually be made to appeal to progressives and liberals and certainly libertarians and even some conservatives with the right argument. So it seems like a concept that if you sort of strip back some of the demagoguery and some of the kind of electioneering, that is, it's actually appealing to a lot of people. And so it seems like something that could potentially catch on. And it's just a fact that many violent or harmful interactions that people have with the criminal legal system begin with these minor kind of order infractions. So it does stand to reason that you could see some of that harm go away if you just cut down those interactions.
Jamiles, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jamiles Lardy is a staff writer for the Marshall Project. And earlier we talked with UW-Madison sociologist John Eason, who heads the UW Justice Lab working on equity and justice issues. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.